No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we won't take it.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. We have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, we'll have Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup to talk about the weekly news. Then I will play some of my recorded interviews I did yesterday while in Madison covering the mining bill. Following that, Jason Lewis Huberty will be on to talk about what happened in the gallery last night and the arrests that occur in the Capitol. In the second hour, I have Matt Rothschild from The Progressive. He'll be on to discuss the President's State of the Union address and the State of the State address. We'll finish off the second hour talking to Lori Compass about the recall and on Scott Fitzwalker. Yeah, I know, it's Scott Fitzgerald, but at this point, they're kind of the same person. Scott Fitzgerald, Scott Walker, so that's kind of Scott Fitzwalker. If you have any questions or comments, you can call in at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. We also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com where you can post all your comments or questions. Now I'd like to welcome Yuri Raskin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Good morning, Yuri.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. How are you doing this morning?
You know, the sun is out. It's a great day in Wisconsin.
Ever since we got those million signatures in, every day has been a great day in Wisconsin.
You know, it's been really kind of interesting, don't you think? Because we as people were charged ourselves with getting the signatures and getting the recall started. And we did what we said we were going to do. Now it's somewhat out of our hands because there's all sorts of other candidates that have to step up, procedures have to work through, and yet, there's a kind of an interesting in-between stage right now that I think we're in. So
it is, and it's a little frightening because the Republicans are taking this moment to post all the addresses, or actually post all the petitions. I don't know if the Republicans are, but the petitions are being posted. And Republicans are actually taking the postings and starting to harass people who signed. Because, you know, they couldn't get enough of us harassing the signature people while they're out getting signatures. They might as well do it now that they're not gathering signatures anymore.
Wow. You know, before too long, Scott Walker is going to be known as the next Joe McCarthy. But until we get there, it's not going to be pretty.
Or Mussolini.
So, well, I hope it doesn't get that bad. Although, you know, are the trains running on time? Anyway, moving on. We have had a state of the state speech. And I took a little bit of liberty and time to go through it and see exactly what Scott Walker claimed. Because, you know, he lives in somewhat of an alternate reality to the rest of us. So I thought, well, what did he say? And so I looked at the report and it said that during a 45-minute address to members of state legislature, Supreme Court, first-term governor touted improved business climate. He said that it created thousands of new jobs, and after the state lost 150,000 jobs during the 3 year prior to that. And so I went to the PolitiFact to kind of start and see what was going on. And it turns out that apparently Scott Walker and the state of Wisconsin is in the net a gain of 13,500 jobs since he took office. So his claim of thousands of jobs is technically correct. However, as we all know by now, in the last 6 months, Wisconsin did nothing but lose and lose jobs. And the numbers keep getting less and less pretty. So that alone, I think, is, of course, Scott Walkerism right there. And, the governor asked small businesses to hire one employee this year in an attempt to invigorate the job market even more throughout the state. As Mary Erpenbach wrote on her Facebook, I guess we should all go to our small businesses and ask them to honor Scott Walker's request and hire us because that's what Scott Walker asked people to do. I don't think that's exactly going to happen, but so there's Scott Walker for you. Of course, people were shouting liar, recall, and liar while he was speaking, and people were taken out of the room where he was giving his speech. And thank goodness Arthur was right there taping everything, and so we have video footage to show what was going on. Walker Walker, looking back on his first year in office, said the state is headed in the right direction. He took credit for a state budget that was balanced without raising taxes, which, of course, is hilarious because, for me, on the city level, I know that we were struggling to find every penny, every dollar we could to keep our services going because state shared revenue was cut. And so the buck was passed on to local governments to continue to provide services, or we look like, you know, we're not able to deliver to our residents. And Scott Walker can walk around and say, look, we cut all of these expenses. So he says that it's not a budgeting gimmick, but what else is it besides
well,
the majority?
And the thing is, too, is that he talks about those stupid tools that he always gave. Well, those tools are like you guys having to cut things. So, yeah, he doesn't look like the bad guy. He goes, oh, look, Janesville had to cut so many things out. Oh, that's too bad. I wonder why that happened. And it's the Janesville board that looks bad. But it really is, in essence, the policies that Walker put into place that you had to respond to.
Absolutely. As going on with his speech, he mentioned that, of course, in his opinion, the business climate in the state has improved. That's part of he's headed in the right direction. Well, I looked that up because, you know, there's such amazing thing as Google, and it says that Wisconsin is snubbed once again in business climate rankings. In a story in Business Beat, which actually came out in November, Site Selection Magazine apparently have not heard that Wisconsin is open for business because they left us off their top 25 states for business climate. Of course, number one is Texas, North Carolina, and the other states that are right to work, because if you really think about it, what does this business-friendly climate really stand for? It means running for cheapest labor, for cheapest cost of business. This is, I guess, what made China such a good business climate. So it's this taking things out of context and starting to, you know, a downward spiral. Now, I'm talking to local businesses who are doing better, especially if they have national customers and they're sending their product because the national economy is improving, which is awesome for all of us. But they're saying that products in China are getting more expensive, the quality is not as good, so they're looking at shifting manufacturing and supplies to get them from the United States. Again, wonderful thing. But if you look at Wisconsin and businesses that are trying to get to this open for business mentality, that means rolling over for businesses and providing the cheapest possible labor force, because that's where businesses theoretically are going to go until they realize the quality of work. So it's a race to nowhere. We don't want to win this race, and yet Scott Walker is trying to get us there and promoting it as a good thing.
Well, maybe that's why he's hiring all the people from Texas. He feels if he can bring enough Texas people up, we might move up a couple spots.
Exactly. We'll be just like Texas, and isn't that a great thing? Not. Unless we're talking about Texas Steakhouse, but that could be okay. So, yes, I'm going through all of these statistics because there are lots of numbers, and interestingly enough, we did beat Texas on two, actually, statistics. And first of all, we have lower unemployment than they do, and we have lower poverty than they do, because we treat our people better, at least we used to.
So there's, you know, that's good for Wisconsin, but apparently Walker would like us to all be just like Texas, so that seems to be where we're headed.
Exactly. Now, moving back to the speech, of course, he lauded, you know, he starts programs, he starts task force, and there's a group of more than 100 protesters gathered outside of the Capitol building to decry the governor's conservative agenda. Protesters were also heard chanting in the Capitol Rotunda as a protester band played outside below the assembly chamber windows. Tell me, is this an environment where business would want to relocate to this state? Are you kidding me? This is not a good business environment. You can see it without reading any statistics. You can just look at it and go, this is not a good place for my business. It's volatile. It's volatility. As a business, you want stability. You want predictability. You want to know what you're getting yourself into. Scott Walker is shaking the state off of its foundation, not just not in a good way, but it also creates a lot of volatility, uncertainty, which is bad for business.
Well, and the thing is, too, is that the country got downrated because of the fact that there was such volatility in the politics that was going on the federal level. So if you're getting downrated for that and you see that same thing here, then, you know, it's just you're going to see the same type of response. We're not going to get downrated, as far as I know, but you're going to see people, like you said, businesses aren't going to want to come here. It's too crazy. They have no idea what's going on. So we have a governor who's not only in the process of getting recalled, but in the process of being investigated by the FBI. We have, you know, we have four other senators being recalled. So there's this, you have lawmakers that were in for 6 months or a year who are no longer in anymore. It's just, that's not what businesses are looking for.
No. And to say that this is normal, that this is just people upset about losing an election, we have never seen this kind of level of civil involvement, and there's a reason for that. This is not just politics taken to a new level because we're just not going to accept results of election. There's lots of elections that don't go our way, and we go and we vote the next time. But this is different, and I think everybody except for Scott Walker, I guess, can see that it is. Now, I did some calculations, and I see that at least in our area, and probably around the state, we're going to vote up to six times this year because we're going to have a primary for spring election or maybe a judge election in some places. Then you're going to have spring election. You're going to have primary for recalls, I hope. Then you're going to have a recall election itself. Then we're going to have a primary for general election on August 14th, where I'm going to be on the ballot. And then we're going to have a November general election, where I also plan to be on the ballot, but we're going to have six opportunities as Wisconsin voters to go and vote this year. Isn't that great?
If you're a voter, it's amazing. I love it. I'm having a great time. So, but we don't have any recalls in our area other than the governor, and I'm having a great time. So all those people who have recalls are great. So,
of course, people in other districts would tell you that that just gives you more time and opportunity to travel to other districts and help those good people recall their senators, as well as help on the Scott Walker on the statewide level. If you're interested, there's always something to do. It's wonderful. Now, Scott said, and I feel like I'm being on a first-name basis with him, even though I've never met him, but goodness, we spend so much time talking about him.
We do, don't we?
Yes.
I think it's a little too much time talking about him, but unfortunately, he's kind of like the gift that keeps on giving. He's popping up everywhere.
Yeah, I suppose we talk about Santa quite a bit, and we've never met him.
Very true.
So he says that he balanced the state budget. Yes, that's been one of his very important talking points, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that to keep the possibility alive of making further cuts to state health programs, the Walker administration quietly certified to the federal government that the state had a deficit. Federal law allows the state to drop tens of thousands of adults to save money on health care costs. We've been talking about this, you know, over and over, about the 53,000 adults that could be dropped off health care. But the way to do that is to declare that you have a deficit. So I guess Wisconsin technically has a deficit. Thanks, Scott Walker, for being so upfront and honest about what you're doing.
Has he ever been upfront and honest about anything he's done?
I would have to ask his parents, but as far as we know, not really. You know, he is supposedly an Eagle Scout, so I hope that he's been upfront about something at some point. So
you know, the one thing that I found interesting about the speech, because I was lucky enough to be on the floor.
Right.
But one of the things I found very interesting about the speech is that there's a whole bunch of I's. I mean, the entire speech was nothing but I's, me's, ours, I's, me's, ours. There was never anything about Wisconsin, the people of Wisconsin, Wisconsin as a whole. I, we's, ours. It was always about Walker.
I would imagine it probably has something to do with the fact that he is back in election mode. You know, so he has to promote himself in that kind of a campaign mode because the campaign season in Wisconsin doesn't end. So he's not You know, so he continues on touting his short-lived, quote, you know, accomplishments. But it would be nice if he were to think bigger than himself for once.
Well, and the other thing, too, that was interesting, it was the fact that he talked about everything he had done. He only mentioned two things that he was going to do, and there were the two task force. You had the fraud task force. I don't have it in front of me, so I don't have the full name. And then you had the reading task force. He said, we are going to go with this. But the rest of it was completely him going, this is what I have done. But it never gave a focus on this is what I want to do. It never, we never focused to the future. You know, State of the State is supposed to be, hey, you could spend 10 minutes of this is what I've done, and then another 35, 40 minutes of here's where the state's going to go. Here's where I want you, the people of Wisconsin, the citizens of Wisconsin, to help me bring the state. And you never heard any of that. What you heard was, here, look at everything I've done.
And you never will, because that's not Scott Walker's approach. His approach is to drop the ball. You know, it's not to outline his plans and then follow through. No. It's to say the most harmless thing he can possibly think of, and then, when behind closed doors, unveil his radical agenda and push forward with it with as little public input as possible. That's been his. He's been very consistent in that. So I'm not surprised that he again didn't say anything in State of the Speech address, because he's going to surprise us with something. You know, he's going to do that.
Oh, absolutely. After he talks to the Koch brothers to get it approved, then he'll push it through.
You got to have somebody's approval, right? And, hey, this is once again a reminder that we have money in politics. It's like every time I hear Koch brothers, I think money in politics, not a good thing. Now, he, of course, as you mentioned, talked about the reading program, and he talked about schools and how he's helping schools. Well, what did I do? I just thought I'd Google that. And I Googled exactly what he said, which is, are Scott Walker's reforms helping schools save money? And what was very interesting about that is that this is how our language is becoming controlled. If you Google that, then you come up with nothing but GOP websites that do stretch statistics and find whatever talking points and repeat whatever talking points they came up with in the first place to keep saying that same thing. But if you, and I thought, well, this is interesting. It's like we have two alternate universes. Okay, so what if I put in there, did Scott Walker cut schools? And then I go, well, instantly there's lots and lots of information on how he did cut funding and how 410 out of 424 Wisconsin public school districts will receive less aid. We have, you know, $800 to $900 million that is cut. And if you look a little deeper, there's an interesting statistic from Department of Public Instruction that says that there's 13 districts see increase of about $1 million total, and there's 410 districts that will see a decrease of hundreds of millions of dollars. So, again, it's two different alternate universes, and if you follow Scott Walker, you never even come in contact with accurate information. It's bizarre.
I like his reality almost. It's almost friendlier. It's almost happier. It's almost like, look, everyone is okay and everyone is doing well.
It's a very interesting observation. There's an old Soviet joke about a teacher that tells story to kids in Soviet Union in kindergarten, and the teacher follows the government propaganda line and says, you know, in Soviet Union, every child has a toy. Every child has this right to education, you know, whatever. Every child has all these wonderful things. And this little boy starts crying, and teacher goes, "What's wrong, little boy?" He goes, "I want to go live in Soviet Union." We're already there. We just don't know about it because it doesn't really affect it, because it's really kind of an imaginary land. My goodness. So
I have a quick question from the chat room. We're going to get off of the State of the State, which is so much more fun to talk about because it's so horrible. But Oak Parker wants to know what we think of the poll showing Walker winning the recall vote. And I know there's a poll. I saw the poll that came out, and it put Walker up against four or five people, and he won in each one.
You know, that's a very interesting observation because I looked at that as well, and it was done by Marquette Law School. And let's see, they did a survey of 701 registered voters, and Tom Barrett, Scott Walker is beating him by 50-44. Dane County Executive Kathleen Falk, who has announced that she will run for nomination to challenge Walker, trails Walker 49-42. Dave Obey loses by 7 points, Tim Cullen by 10 points. So, yes, all of these fine people are down between 6 and 10 points. And, again, as referencing to our own poll that we did on our website, Defend Wisconsin News Roundup, Barrett, Falk, Cullen, Senator Cole all have extremely low favorability ratings with those grassroots that are most active. So we have the Kathleen Weinhout, for instance, who was not mentioned in the survey, John Erpenbach, who was not mentioned in the survey. So we have there's an interesting disconnect here. So that's number one. So those that Democrats would feel most passionate about don't seem to be even included in the poll. Number two, it's early, and Scott Walker has had a distinct advantage. As you can probably guess, I'm no big fan of Scott Walker, and I received 10, 11 mail pieces from him in the last few days, promoting and highlighting, him walking around or looking busy. So, he has advantage right there. We all talk about him. He's got good name recognition. In politics, you know, as long as they spell your name right, that's supposed to be a good thing. And even though lots of people think that Walker's first name is Recall, everybody knows Scott Walker. And who this, Senator Cullen, he's this great guy in Janesville, but does anybody in northern Wisconsin know about him? Not necessarily. So there's lots and lots of reasons, but it is a very interesting starting point because it also says that we are not doing... Scott Walker has divided the state, and if you like Scott Walker, you are not going to listen to other kind of information. We just tune out the other side, and we need to communicate with each other. We need to talk to each other as regular people and find out what's important. And because I believe that if you just let somebody else talk to you and explain to you what they care about, you can clearly point out to them how Scott Walker is hurting that particular issue with his behavior and his agenda.
If they'll listen to that, because the minute you come out with a facts or figures, they'll find something from the Heritage Foundation that will say otherwise.
You are talking to some educated conservatives, huh?
Well, from the Heritage Foundation, I don't know if I'd call them educated, but they definitely have something that they can throw back. Now, where was that sampling done? Does it say anything about... how that was taken? Did they call people by phone? Was it all over the state?
That was on the phone. Let's see. The survey of 701 registered voters was taken by telephone from January 19th to 22nd. It's a fairly representative poll, at least on the face of it, but obviously, as you and I know, landlines are on their way out. I'm talking to you on a cell phone. This is my main number, and so is for most people. Is it going to register? Am I going to get telephone polls? Pollsters are trying to change this because they want some reliability for their information, but you're getting older demographic and all sorts of things.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say if you're looking at just a landline, that's the only way they got the information, you are going to have it a little skewed, and it's not the fault of Marquette because obviously telephone is easier than having a telephone, sending people out in front of stores and, you know, the different three or four different going online and doing it. That would be a more representative sample because you're hitting all age groups. But when you focus just on the phone, you're looking at an older population more than likely, because even some of your poorer populations will go straight to, they'll have one or the other. They're not going to have both. And usually it's going to be a prepaid cell phone instead of a landline. So you're really getting a little bit of a skew with the sampling. And again, it's not as much as Marquette's fault. They're telling you that it's a little skewed because they're doing the phone only. But a better representation would have been three or four different ways. But that's hard to do on a very short amount of time.
Exactly. Now, the final thing that I wanted to cover with Scott Walker's speech is that he talked about that committee task force, whatever you want to call it, that you refer to. And we have Representative Mark Pocan, who I'm sure you know very well, who served on that commission and wrote a very interesting blog post on it that I think everyone should check out. And it's called Walker Sham Waste Fraud and Abuse Commission, where he highlights the top five problems with Governor Walker's Waste, Fraud, and Abuse Commission report. And number one problem that he points out is that the report takes credit for passing federal legislation. And this is obviously not the first time we've seen Scott Walker do that. And it says in its court debt collection section, the report recommend passage of H.R. 1416, which they say would save $5.4 to $27 million. How can this commission with a straight face take credit for passage of a bill that hasn't even passed the United States Congress? Number two, the report makes suggestions that could deny food share to poor people. The Walker report suggests requiring photo IDs to be added to the Quest food share card, yet readily admits that federal policies require the state to permit all members of household to use that card, reducing the effectiveness of any enforcement efforts. Number three, Governor Walker already busted unions, but he wants to take credit for it again. The section on overtime rules for public workers takes credit for changes already set in motion by the Republican Anti-Collective Bargaining Act 2011, Act 10. In fact, the commission's report takes credit for savings that it even admits are already underway. Number four, Governor Walker's inconsistency on tax cheaters. The report recommends spending an additional $10 million each year to hire more revenue agents to crack down on tax cheats. And when Governor Walker said publicly he supports passing all recommendation in the report, we thought he meant that he'd support investing more money to crack down on tax cheats. But that doesn't seem to be the case, since the Walker administration is attempting to cut $2 million that is supposed to go toward hiring more revenue agents. So how can Governor pledge to spend more money to crack down on tax cheats while cutting the current budget? Classic Walker. And number five, everyone loves a budget gimmick. We were led to believe this commission was going to find new savings through clamping down on waste, fraud, and abuse, and yet $50 million of the report relies upon a suggestion that the state require agencies to lapse funds each year, something that both Democratic and Republican legislatures and governors have required in various amounts in the last several biennial budgets. While this has been used, obviously this is doublespeak because this is a budget gimmick. So Scott Walker and his Scott Walkerias. What is that? The word that was created to describe tool job?
Yes, tool job. That's exactly what he is. He's a tool job. Him and Scott Fitzwalker. I'm sorry, Scott Fitzgerald and Jeff Fitzgerald. They are now nicknamed Scott and Jeff Fitzwalker because I can't tell them all apart. They're about the same. So really quickly, we have about 2 minutes left. I wanted just to touch on the reading task force that he's doing. It drives me nuts because every school had a reading specialist. It was set in every school. And in his biannual budget, he cut the reading specialist in the school. And then he proposes this reading task force. It's like, why? If you need a reading task force for kids K through 3, how about just bring back the reading specialist who is helping all the kids in the district and can help specialize it instead of having this cookie-cutter approach? You cannot do cookie-cutter approaches when you're teaching kids in school. You can't do it. It doesn't work. Kids learn differently. There's five or six different ways that people learn.
I'm seeing this on a local level. We've lost reading specialists. And I came in and read to kids in school, and I offered to do that again and again because if you calculate, our children have lost in Janesville School District alone 6,000 educational events a year by losing reading specialists.
That's, and reading is so important. Reading is so important. I understand it has to be a focus, and as it should. But this whole reading task force crap, I don't think it's going to be effective, and I'm pretty sure that he's going to stack it with his donors, which really, how are they going to really affect anything? Or he'll hire people from Texas to do it. So.
Exactly. There's always Texas. It's not necessarily a good thing. With all due respect to all the fine people who live in that great state, we're in Wisconsin, we're different, and we really like it that way.
We do prefer it. I prefer to be a little more a progressive state, and so do the people of Wisconsin. Yuri, thank you so much for being on this week, and we'll talk to you next week. You hang in there?
Absolutely. Campaign's going great. Having lots of fun, and check us out on Facebook.
And we'll get, you know, I want to get you on for the campaign, so we'll talk about that later, but we'll definitely get you on to talk about that and focus on that instead of some of the news. So thank you so much, Yuri. You have a good week now. See you next week.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. After this break, I will be back with my recorded interviews with Secretary of State Doug LaFollette and Mike Wiggins Jr. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
So my lads, I please believe you. My intentions know to grieve you.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Wise observers of U.S. military policy, like Madison activist Alan Ruff and Professor Al McCoy, have long argued that what the Pentagon does overseas eventually comes back and bites us right here at home. A new report by Spencer Ackerman in Wired makes the same point, and it's a disturbing one. The Department of Homeland Security wants to use drones to spy on Americans over 4 square miles for a persistent period of time and beam down the info within 12 seconds to a control room that would be constantly monitoring the action. It's already put out a call to contractors for this wide area surveillance system, as it calls it, and it's planning on testing the system down in Arizona. Plus, there's no indication, says Ackerman, that the Department of Homeland Security plans on getting court orders before peering into your neighborhood from the skies. As it is, drones are already being used to patrol the border right now, and they were even used by law enforcement in North Dakota last year to track down intruders on a ranch. And now Homeland Security wants an ever more intrusive surveillance system. That's great news for the contractors, but horrible news for anyone who respects our Fourth Amendment rights. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As a member of the Jobs Committee, I want to stand up and address this substitute amendment and just talk briefly about what I heard from some of the people who traveled quite a distance. In fact, I believe it was a 15-hour round trip to testify about this bill. And those people were concerned about the public health and the environment. Now, one thing that I know that each and every one of us in this room can agree on is the fact that we desperately need jobs in Wisconsin. I would have to ask, at what cost? As I sat and listened to the people, I sat there and I thought about how I might feel if this were a mine in my backyard and I was concerned about my drinking water and the drinking water of generations to come, as well as the environment. And I sat there and over I heard people talk about that. And then I listened to some other people talk about the impact, the economic impact of what this bill might do, the jobs it may bring. And I actually asked a question to a few of those people who were talking about the economic impact. And I asked, does the economic impact outweigh the environmental impact or the impact on public health? And the people answered the question, yes. And I was amazed at that. I also noted that the people who answered yes didn't live in that area. And they would not have to be concerned about a mine in their backyard and the environmental impact or what the impact might be on public health. And so as I sat there and I listened to that, I looked over this bill and I thought to myself, this is not something that I'd want in my backyard and not something that I could support for the people in my community, and it would be difficult for me to see it any differently when I think about people in another community, because while I'm here to represent Milwaukee, I'm here as a state representative to represent the people in this state, and I truly am concerned about them.
That was Representative Barbara Tolles, who is the representative of the 17th Assembly District, speaking about the mine yesterday. She had a lot more to say, and if you get a chance to watch what she says on WISC-I, it's really worth the time to sit and listen to it. I believe it's a whole about 10 minutes of all of it. She was wonderful. But I was hanging out at the Capitol yesterday and sitting through some of the mining stuff and sitting through the people's voice on the mines. And while I was there, Doug LaFollette, our Secretary of State, came out and spoke against the mine. And I had a chance to interview him when he was done with that. So this is the interview I had with him about the mine. I'm speaking with Secretary of State Doug LaFollette, and we're going to be speaking about the mining bill. Now, you spoke at the there was a session for the mining bill that people can come up and speak about. Can you kind of say what you said while you're up there speaking to the people?
Well, the basic point I made, which is so critical, is we don't need a new mining law. Wisconsin has one of the best mining laws in the Midwest. And there's a chart there in the room that shows exactly what our law is like at the moment. And it's very much like Minnesota, very much like Michigan. And then there's this, quote, new law written for and by the big mining companies from Florida and around the country that only want one thing. They want to get out of our land the resources that will make them a lot of money as quickly as they can without any restrictions and any concern about the future. I also talked about our experience with the Flambeau mine near Ladysmith, where the mining company promised us it was all going to be okay. And they got their permission. They dug a big hole next to the Flambeau River, and they took millions of dollars out of that hole. They went away. And now we discovered that that mine is polluting the water in the Ladysmith area. And we're fighting right now trying to get that water somehow protected. But it's too late. It's now polluted. And so don't trust the mining companies who promise you it'll all be okay. Wisconsin's mining law is good. It gives us some protection. And to weaken that law with what Governor Walker and the Republican leadership that is basically in the pockets of the big mining company want to do is outrageous. It's a crime to our future, and it is an insult to the Native people of northern Wisconsin to whom that land is sacred, the wild rice, the water, the home of their people for generations in the past and in the future, is all threatened by this very short-term attitude of money, money now, and the heck with the future.
The mining company keeps touting about the jobs that they're going to have. Do they have they released any numbers of jobs and how many of these jobs would be hired by Wisconsin hirees versus out-of-state hirees? Do we have any idea on any of that?
You don't know. They promise a lot, but history shows it doesn't work. Professor Al Geddix at La Crosse has done studies of mining all around the country when they promise lots of jobs. What happens is many people come for those jobs, and sometimes the local economy gets worse. It costs money for the schools, for police protection, for roads and streets. The local impact is great, and the number of local jobs turns out to be pretty small. So it's not really worth it in the jobs aspect in terms of what impact it will have on the local economy and on the environment for many, many years in the future.
And the mining bill itself has really taken away a lot of the environmental protections. It's really given the companies pretty much a go-ahead to do what they want without much oversight and without them having to pay for anything in the future as the mine is done, like in the Ladysmith mine. So as they are saying that this is all about jobs, is it really about jobs or is it really just to get their mining buddies in just to mine? Because the ore's not staying in Wisconsin, the ore's not even staying in the United States. They're just rolling back so much. Is it really needed?
Well, of course not. What they want is freedom to do as they please, to get the resources quickly, to make a lot of money. And as I said before, Wisconsin has a good mining law. We wrote that law after our experiences with the Flambeau mine in the Ladysmith area. and we saw that we needed a good law that give people input, protected the environment, and gave long-term security that the mining company could not walk away and leave a polluted situation behind, which they do too often. So we passed a good law, and it's very much like the laws of Michigan and Minnesota. What they want to do now is basically eliminate that law. They won't say that, but if you look through it carefully, they weaken or eliminate most of all the protections that our current law has.
What's the chance that this is actually going to be passed through? And the Assembly is probably great, but the Senate, I've heard, it might pass, it may not pass. What do you think the chances are this bill is going to get through?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball for our legislature, but I think, as you say, the Assembly is so dominated by this new sort of conservative, Koch brothers-dominated Republican legislature that they'll probably pass it. It goes to the Senate where there's more responsible people. And I would hope that some of the Republicans in the Senate will think carefully about what they're really doing, and this mining bill disaster can be stopped in the state Senate.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
That was Secretary of State Doug LaFollette. He has an extensive background in environmental issues. He also started Clean Wisconsin. So when he talks about this stuff, he really knows what he's talking about. Really neat man. I was really excited to be able to sit down and talk with him. Now, this next interview you're going to hear is Mike Wiggins, Jr. Now, he is the chairman of the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa. And he was down there. He spoke at the People's Mine, Assembly of the People's Mine. I can't remember exactly what they called it, but it was people could speak out against the mine, and it was open for everyone to speak. And then he sat and came down into the Assembly for a while. And they came down. They left 4 in the morning yesterday. There's two buses that came down from the Bad River Reservation, and they came down and they talked to people and sat there the whole time. They had to leave, obviously, at 6 because it was a long trip home, and I was able to sit down and speak with him, and here's his interview. I am speaking with Mike Wiggins, Jr. He is the chairman from the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa. Now, he's down here to oppose the mining bill. Can you give just a synopsis of why Bad River Reservation is very opposed to the mining bill?
Sure, it's very simple. The negative environmental impacts associated with taconite mining, and in this case in particular, open pit mining, are catastrophic, destructive. They cover a multitude of negative impacts to water from a particulate matter pollution-based perspective, from a hydrological perspective in the form of the drawdown of groundwater and local streams, creeks. There are lots of things in this legislation to facilitate this coming to fruition, things that relate back to rollbacks of environmental protections, the ability to dump toxic waste sediment in streams, creeks, lakes, the ability to draw down the groundwater aquifer with no recourse for citizenship or affected communities. There's actually a provision in this legislation that would allow GTAC, the mining company, off the hook for any groundwater contamination at depths deeper than 1,000 feet. When you start looking at things like that, we are directly downwind, downstream of this. Our subsistence people. We are close to the land. We hunt, fish, gather wild rice from the base of our homeland, and we are recognizing all of these things and more as imminent threats to our existence and what we have.
How much cultural damage would be done by the mine?
Well, it's everything. Cultural damage is almost a luxury when you think of the human health impacts and in the form of mercury pollution to mothers and babies, when you think of the loss of the ability to gather wild rice and feed our families, when you factor in the potential hydrological drawdown of the water table, so maybe our sturgeon fishery and our walleye fisheries in the Bad River are no longer healthy. It's about life and death, really, and through that filter, that's all culturally based. It's everything right now. So it transcends culture. It transcends a lot of perspectives. You know, health, the spiritual realm, the environmental realm, our culture, the things we hold sacred, how we connect to our lands, our waters, our history and our thousand-year history of environmental stewardship. I mean, our waters are pristine and clear, and we do a service for Wisconsin and the world, really, when you think of the billions of gallons of water that come through our wetland complexes, and they're enriched, they're purified, and they're sent on to Lake Superior, Gitche-Gumee. This all culminates into kind of a cumulative kind of picture that culture is just a piece of. It's everything. It's life.
Now, the Republicans have been saying that this is a jobs bill, and they've been talking about all the thousands of jobs. They were just saying it on the floor, the thousands of jobs that would be created by this mining bill. Do you know any number? Have you been given a number of possible jobs, and do we know what salary range we're looking at, health care benefits, anything like that? Have you heard anything about it?
If you look at northern Minnesota, you look at northern Michigan, where there are extractive industries operating, there is a phenomena called the resource curse that usually accompanies a lot of these communities. First of all, there is no manna from heaven in terms of jobs and money for everyone. What typically follows these types of communities is impoverishment because of the boom and bust cycle associated with iron mining. And it's the communities that are near the resources that end up the most impoverished. And you combine that with the fact that most of the decisions related to the environment and other types of matters that impact these local communities are made by people who do not live in that area. And we're seeing that today here in Madison for a Florida-based mining company. That combo forms what is usually associated with the resource curse. And part of that equation and part of this curse is the fact that eventually the local impacted communities are dependent, almost like addicted, to that extractive industry. And all these other sustainable jobs, the notions of green energy, notions of tourism-based industry, notions of good, clean living. In our Chippewa language, we call that Bamata Ziwin, you know, trying to live that good life, close to the land, clean air, clean water. All those things are gone on the backside of these types of projects, along with these limited liability mining companies like Ogebic Taconite. And what's left? The very thing that makes us rich in the beginning, the very gifts of Mother Nature, are gone, exploited, and now it's a double whammy. Impoverishment, plus you've had your resources exploited, and on the backside of it, you can pray that there's some type of reclamation process, but we already see similar operations, similar taconite mining operations leaching poisons. So it's you know, I don't get carried away on propaganda of jobs, jobs, jobs. I heard GTAC themselves talk last January that they were going to phase in 30 workers over the first couple years, 30 local workers and 30 of their own. And then they got a little shady about how that would grow and develop. Well, within a month, it was thousands of jobs are going to be created. Well, I heard directly from GTAC Representative Matt Fifield back in January. That's on public record. It was a public hearing at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center. If people can find that on NPR or whatever, they'll hear themselves just what that labor report looked like. If I could say this, it was interesting because why the Pinokies, why now? GTAC said, well, we're technologically superior. We can do things safer. We're using the latest cutting-edge technology. But then later on, when they started talking jobs, I'll say this. They were going to use the latest cutting-edge technology, and thus they were different than northern Minnesota. They were different than the UP of Michigan. But later, when they started talking jobs, all of a sudden, we're going to employ this many people. And how do we know this? Because we looked at comparable mining operations in Michigan and in Minnesota. So when they wanted to say why the Pinokies, why now, they were different than other taconite mining operations, safer. When they wanted to talk jobs, they were exactly like other taconite mining operations. And that is convenience. That is not integrity. And ultimately, these legislators in Madison today are taking an absolute blind leap of faith, a leap of faith that is putting too much public interest and public trust in a mining company that is out of state looking to profit.
Have they been forward with you with any of the process so far? I mean, they said they wanted to test drill. They've never test drilled. They never put in a permit, yet they want this mining bill to pass. You said they started out with saying how many jobs. Now all of a sudden it's a huge amount of jobs, and they don't seem to be really specifying anything or really coming out and really specifically mentioning anything. It's all very vague and all very, well, we'll tell you if we have to. Have they ever been forward with you on anything when you've asked them questions, specific questions?
No. In fact, that same hearing last January, a year ago, they promised the Wisconsin public that they were going to implement their project under the quote-unquote very strict regulatory framework of Wisconsin, that would be part of the process. They were going to be transparent. They were going to do this under current mining law. That was a lie. That was a lie, because at the same time, they had their lobbyists working on what was a failed introduction of a bill called LRB 2035. That was a corporate wish list of how to profit at the expense of the environment and at the expense of people. Unfortunately, the current bill that we're seeing in Madison and that was just passed by the assembly is darn near a copy of what was originally put forward by GTAC. I'll leave people to put the dots together on that themselves, but that was not truthful. That company was not truthful with the people of the North. And again, there's a blind leap of faith taking place today. You know, we could use a little bit of Missouri right now, because we've been shown, and they've shown us. And a person from Missouri, from the Show Me State, would already know what the score was.
So do you think then that it comes down to this? You obviously, the environment is going to be completely destroyed if this mining bill goes through. Are you looking at jobs from a mining versus jobs from tourism? And what is a greater pull, and what do you think would be better in the area?
There, if there was as much time, energy, lobbying, lawyers working on good, green, sustainable jobs as there were this attack on the environment, we would see green industry being discussed. We would see sustainable jobs, sustainable energy being looked at. And we would see that reconciled with the tourism-based surge, and because there's lots of things you can do from a tourist-based perspective. But again, right now, those are luxuries, because we're about to embark on a potential dependency on an extractive industry.
Now, when it comes to treaty rights, how does this bill affect your treaty rights, and what say do you have with fighting it on that level?
Well, our treaty rights, I mean, the context of northern Wisconsin is from an Indian perspective, is it ceded territory. The northern third of Wisconsin is covered by treaty rights that there's currently 11 Ojibwe tribes, Ojibwe and Chippewa being synonymous. There's 11 Ojibwe tribes that sit there with usufructuary rights, the ability to hunt, fish, and gather. It's a violation of federal law if those are diminished. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you could look at the whole notion of the Northwoods becoming an industrialized mining district from a perspective of diminished harvesting possibilities. But more than that, as sovereign nations, we reserved, you know, we live on reservations, and there was a reservation. Well, we reserved the right to live, to survive, and to do that, almost from a basic human rights standpoint, you need clean air, you need clean water, and you need to be able to take care of yourself. Well, we have all that. We recognize it, and we work to maintain that. We're going to be around another 1,000 years. Right now, there's decisions being made in that assembly that I fail to see how they're looking through that same kind of lens for on behalf of future generations. It's the id mentality, as Sigmund Freud put it. I want what I want when I want it, and I want it now.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you sitting down. It's been a really long day, and I appreciate you sitting down and talking with me.
That was Mike Wiggins, Jr., the chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Like I said, they came down yesterday. They helped. He spoke at the People's Assembly for the mine. He came down to the assembly, was kind of an honored guest. I don't think he spoke at all there. He's been talking to people all day. I hope he was talking to lawmakers, because the lobbyists get a whole heck of their time, and the people don't get as much. So, and just to let people know, too, when the assembly is in session, there are lobbyists that come in and out and sit on the sides. They don't go into the assembly hall, but they're kind of sitting and milling around, and they come in and out. So don't think that they're just coming to their office and talking with them. They're hanging out as the bill is being passed. So it's nice to see that people can actually get in and speak their mind. And hopefully his words had a lot of weight to it. He's talking as a sovereign nation to these lawmakers, and I really hope they heard him. Apparently some of the Republican Assembly members didn't, but I really hope the Senate does. So we're going to go to break right now. And after the break, we're going to have Matt Rothschild, who is from the Progressive magazine. We'll be talking to him about the President's State of the Union address and Walker's State of State address. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show.
So there you sit in your cushy chair, just keep on doing all the talking. Woo-hoo.
Putting to you, how much for the life?
of a miner. It should come as no surprise. You'll hear them spout the same old lies. Every time a miner dies, how much for the life of a miner? Somewhere far away from here, accountants will project. Actuaries speculate on causes and effects. No pesky regulations from the seas that they elect. And auditors confirm the yields from their benign neglect. Each state sets a price for a leg that's lost. Lose an arm or an ear, there's a preset cost. When the air goes bad and there's no exhaust. Oh, how much for the life of a miner? Slap on the wrist or a paltry fine. Reversed on appeal on down the line. An act of God, the court opine. How much for the life of a miner? Politicians posture at the mine face solemnly. Live reporters swarm like flies around the tragedy. Preachers will proclaim the Lord behaves mysteriously. And PR spokesmen orchestrate deniability. And now their widows, sons and daughters come to you and me. And ask how much for the life of a miner. How much for the life of a miner.
So there you sit in your cushy chair, just keep on doing all the talking.
Welcome back. The second hour of the Sarah Schultz Show starts with Matt Rothschild, who is the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Sarah. Thanks for having me back on. It's always fun.
Oh, it's always a blast. You always bring so much information. It's great to have you on and really get your voice out there speaking about what's really going on. So let's start out with the State of the Union address that President Obama did on Tuesday. I can't believe it's been such a crazy week. I can't believe that that happened just Tuesday. But what was your overall feel of the speech?
Well, I know a lot of people loved it, but for me it was just kind of a lackluster speech, warmed over populism, economic populism, which I like, but I don't think it was his best speech ever about this income inequality that we're facing, nor his best defense of the role of government, far from it. I like the fact that he was calling for economic fairness and said economic fairness is the biggest issue of our day. I agree with that. But, on a lot of issues, he was really lacking. And, for instance, he said he was still open to that grand compromise with John Boehner and the Republicans on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. This wouldn't be a grand compromise. It would be a disaster, and we don't need a Democrat to be cutting these crucial social programs. We need to strengthen the social safety, not rip more holes into it. And so he didn't need to do that. I mean, he's still kind of playing this silly game that maybe there's some chance of bipartisanship left and holding out these olive branches that Republicans have been sawing off constantly. So that was distressing. And if it bodes ill for the next term of an Obama administration that he's really going to start slashing Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, that really is going to leave voters with not much of a choice when they go in to vote in November. But the thing that really, ticked me off the most, I think, was an unexpected, totally unnecessary passage in the State of the Union address where he went after single-payer, universal single-payer health care. And he did so by quoting a favorite quote that Ronald Reagan used to use all the time of Abraham Lincoln's, where Lincoln said, government should do for people only what they can't do better by themselves and no more. Well, certainly that's a quote that's open for interpretation, because there's a lot of things that people can't do for themselves, like health care. I mean, I can't give myself health insurance, much less operate on myself. If I've got a need for a heart bypass or chemotherapy, I can't do that work. We need health care. People can't provide it for themselves. But Obama used that passage not to say the government needs to be more involved in health care, but to say, I left my health care bill and the policy that flowed from it in the hands of the private sector rather than in the hands of the government. So he was saying the private sector can handle health care better than the government can, which is false. And Obama himself knows it's false, because Obama himself was for single-payer health care when he was a state senator in Illinois. And when he was running for president, he said, as a hedge, well, I used to be for single-payer, but I can't now because we've got such a mixed system. It would be impossible to do. But if I had to build a health care policy from scratch, I'd certainly have single-payer. And now what does he do? He trashes. He trashes single payer and all those people who are supporting it in order to score some cheap political points. It was a tiny passage in the State of the Union. There were more important ones there, but this is the one that really got my goat.
Well, I wasn't really fond of that passage either, probably because I have heard that before with some of the neocons. They like to stout that passage. They like to throw it out. I think some of the GOPers, even not even the neocons, but some of the more moderate ones, I put that in quotes, have said it. And when he said it, that got a huge rise from the Republican side, and I just kind of cringed.
Well, there were a lot of moments that were cringing. Another cringeable moment, if we might use that new word, that was when Obama started talking about Iran. I mean, this is when the crowd of elected officials got to be the most raucous. And actually, the applause was almost blood-curdling when he talked about Iran, when he said we'd take no options off the table. And that's a pretty simple code for saying we will threaten to obliterate Iran with nuclear weapons if it dares to acquire or come close to acquiring a single nuclear weapon, even though we have thousands of them and Israel has hundreds of them. This reliance on nuclear weapons, which is actually an extension of the doctrine, the new national security doctrine that Obama issued a couple of weeks ago, is very frightening. And even if Obama doesn't follow through on this threat to bomb Iran with nuclear weapons, if he doesn't win re-election, the Republicans can say, well, I'm just following through on the Obama policy here.
And that was another one that really bothered me. One of the things I tweeted was, please don't get us in another war. And if not only did it bother me with the hit, he was saying that and making a point to say that with our warships in the area, but he's also just, I don't know if it was before or after that, had said that let's take half of what we were spending in Afghanistan and throw it into one of the other programs. And I thought, how are we going to afford it? If you're already saying, you know, all the money we're saving from not fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq, let's throw it into some of these areas. There's no way to actually support another war. And do we really need more problems in the Middle East? We are causing our own issues there by constantly going to war.
Yeah, and it's interesting, in the new national security doctrine, he was faulted by some Republicans by saying we can't fight or we can no longer fight two big ground wars at the same time, which was always a ludicrous thing for the Pentagon to insist that it had to do. But so what Obama said was, look, we'll just be prepared to fight one major ground war, and if there's another threat that arises, we'll threaten to obliterate that country with nuclear weapons, whether it's Iran or any other country. So the government of Barack Obama is more reliant on nuclear weapons as a threat, as a club, than the previous administrations have said. And even though Obama says, you know, he wants to rid the world of nuclear weapons, he now says, well, as long as there are nuclear weapons out there, even though the U.S. and the Russians have 95% of all of them, we're going to make use of them in this threatening way. At the same time that he says, you know, we want to eliminate the use of nuclear weapons, that's one of the threats. So it's very distressing to have a Democratic president clinging to nuclear weapons like this and then brandishing them.
It also sets a very dangerous precedent, where you come against us or say something against us, we're going to threaten just to destroy you. I don't want to be in a country that's known like that.
But that's standard operating procedure and has been really since the dawn of the nuclear age, which the United States ushered in by dropping two nuclear weapons on Japan. We were the only country ever, after all, to have done that, to use nuclear weapons in warfare. But the United States has used nuclear weapons as a threat repeatedly, not just in the Cuban Missile Crisis, but in the 1973 Yom Kippur War in Israel. The United States threatened to use them. The United States threatened to use them against China in the Korean War and many other times. And so that's one area where the whole world could blow up still with nuclear weapons. It was not for nothing that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists recently turned the doomsday clock from 6 minutes to doomsday to 5 minutes to doomsday, because not only of nuclear weapons but also climate change. And, you know, in Obama's speech, he didn't talk much about global climate change either, and his policy on that, though his rhetoric is better than Bush's, his policy actually isn't much better than Bush's.
Well, if that wouldn't be hard, but
wouldn't be hard to have better rhetoric, because Bush and
yeah,
Bush's
it wouldn't
people
be hard.
Were, I mean, they were denying that, you know, global warming was even a scientific fact for the longest time, and then they insisted on doing essentially nothing about it.
Yep. There's a statement, Oak Parker says, I think the President of the United States was attempting to blunt some Republican talking points. She continues saying, we are never going to have a President or Congress as progressive as we are. It's frustrating, and it doesn't mean we don't push to at least return the country to the center. Do you think he was actually trying to blunt a little bit of these talking points that are going to come at him on the campaign trail?
I sure do. I mean, for instance, when he said you know, the United States is the one indispensable nation in world affairs, and as long as I'm president, I intend to keep it that way. I mean, this was cheap jingoism to counter, you know, cheap Gingrichisms, which have been flowing at him from Newt Gingrich, especially if you saw Gingrich's speech Saturday night after the South Carolina primary. He was basically calling Obama un-American, and so this was Obama's way of saying, you know, I am, you know, as American, as in jingoistic as Gingrich is. Gingrich said Obama didn't believe in American exceptionalism. Well, this is the very definition of exceptionalism. You know, we're the indispensable nation out there. And so I do think that's a good observation, that he's trying to protect his flank preemptively from the Republicans who are going to be coming at him, and who are coming at him right now, actually.
What was some of the – just save two of the good points that he had in his speech. We were talking about some of the ones that we don't like, but what do you think are the two best points he had?
Well, economic fairness was the main good point, and then there's some subpoints in there, taxing the millionaires and things like that, and supporting another one would be supporting some green technology. So those are two good points he had in there, but you know, by and large, I just – didn't think it was a great speech. I mean, technically, it just went on and on and on and on. But substantively, you know, if he's going to be compromising on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, wow.
Yeah, and I really hope that was just rhetoric. I really hope that he actually doesn't kowtow to these neocons. I really hope he was just saying that to get people to, I don't know, I don't even know what he's attempting to do with that, but...
But again, it sets the stage for, you know, if a Republican wins, all the Republican has to say is, assume it's Romney, look, Barack Obama agreed that we need to do something about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and he was ready to do it, and so now I'm going to do it. And there's not much of a rejoinder that Democrats can offer there when they, you know, backed Obama's ridiculous so-called grand compromise.
Now, going back to the Gingrichisms, how long do you see this crazy Republican rhetoric continuing to pander to the extreme right?
I think on this issue, they don't have that much to run on, the Republicans. What they're going to run on is Obama doesn't believe in America as the greatest country on earth. Obama goes around the world apologizing for America. Obama's making America weaker by cutting the defense. That's the main attack that's going to come at him from either Gingrich or Romney. They both of them talk about this, you know, Obama not seeming like he's a real American. Gingrich was saying it, you know, you wonder what country he's from, and he wants to turn the United States into a bureaucratic socialist country. So that's the line of attack here, and they're going to seize on some passages and speeches Obama made early in his administration where he admitted that, you know, the United States overthrew the government of Iran in 1954 and other things that the United States did, which I was glad Obama was frank about. But they're going to seize on that and say, look, this is no way for a president to be, and we've got to continue to be the greatest country on earth. I mean, at Gingrich's speech, you know, you could hear the USA, USA, USA chants, and that's the angle they're going to play up.
We're talking with Matt Rothschild from the Progressive. He's an editor from the Progressive magazine. And you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show. If you have any questions for Matt, you can call in at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. Now, I'm going to change and talk about the State of the State address that happened Wednesday night from Governor Walker. And what was your overall impression of that?
No, I thought it was pathetic. I mean, and it was also so revealing because what Walker said was, he's had a good first year because he delivered on his promise, and his constituents liked what he did, but his constituents are big business. His constituents aren't the voters of Wisconsin. And so what was he bragging about in the speech? He was bragging that 95% of what he called job creators believe Wisconsin's headed in the right direction. That's 94% of business people. Of course they like what he's doing. He's their representative. He's their puppet. They would like what he's doing. So for him to cite that poll, I think, was more damning than anything. I mean, he said, again, employers appreciate that we took our fiscal problems seriously. He is the governor of the employers, and it couldn't have been more clear. In this speech, he also made ludicrous claims about jobs improving in Wisconsin when actually Wisconsin has the worst job record of any state in the union over the last 6 months, losing jobs 6 months in a row. And so he said essentially black is white and white is black. He talked about the mining bill as being necessary and safe, and he was bragging about how he was pushing that through. He managed with a straight face to praise teachers, even though his whole attack on collective bargaining was an assault on teachers, and he even dared to mention infrastructure and rail after he completely let go any hope of doing the high-speed rail and sent the federal hundreds of billions of dollars back. So it was a very peculiar speech, but it showed clearer than ever that who he's really talking to and talking for, and that is the business community.
What I found very interesting about his speech was that there's a bunch of I's. It was all I. And it's also not only I and me, not a Wisconsin and us and the state, but I and me. He also talked about everything he did, but not where we're going. The State of the State, my opinion of it anyway, should be that, hey, this is what, you know, 10 minutes of this is what we did, 30 minutes of this is where we're headed. This is the things I want to implement. And he didn't do any of that. He just said, hey, this is all I did. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to throw a couple task forces in there. And it seemed more to me like a campaign speech than it did about doing anything with the state.
Yeah, and, you know, one task force, again, is cutting more regulations. This is the Small Business Regulatory Review Board that he's setting up. So that again, that's a pipe dream of the business community, and he's following through on that. And then, you know, he just got sappy at the end. Yes, we all should do more in tutoring kids in school, and I'm all for doing that. And he was bragging on how he was doing it. But, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, we should tutor kids in school, and it's another thing then to, you know, be taking money away from the very schools where the teachers themselves would have more resources to help the students in need. So, you know, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth there, and I don't think he won many points with anybody in this very divided state. But the amazing thing about the state of Wisconsin is how divided we are. And the poll that came out this week showing 51% of the people of Wisconsin approve of the job that Scott Walker's doing should give some of us pause here who thought that with these million signatures that we were just going to skate through to the recall election and without too much trouble throw Scott Walker out on his behind. And it's just not going to be that easy.
Talking about that poll, is that that's the Marquette Law poll, isn't it?
Yeah,
that
was
came out. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I mean, so it had his popularity over 50%. It also had him beating everybody whose name has been bandied about in the media in the recall election pretty handily. You know, 50 to 41, 50 to 42, 50 to 43, depending on who the candidate was. And so, what a tragedy it would be after all these tremendous historic protests here, after all the historic recall of the state senators, after this amazing grassroots effort with 30,000 volunteers to get more than a million signatures, then to lose the recall election. If that were to happen, it would just be devastating.
Well, part of it lies in the fact that the mainstream media just kind of takes what he says and just spews it back out. They just allow him to keep with his distortions. They don't really come out and say, you know what, that's really not the case, or that's really not, or he's right here, but they just kind of continue to do that. So,
and it's also part, you know, he's been throwing money at airwaves. I mean, he's had all this, all these commercials up, and they've been unresponded to by the Democrats or by any candidate, because candidates have been laying low with the exception of Cohen, Kathleen Falk. And so there's been no advertising response at all, and that may be why his numbers have improved.
Well, also, too, that poll was done on the telephone. And it's a little bit of a skewed. When you're looking at a telephone, you're looking at an older population. You're looking at a population that maybe just doesn't use your cell phone because they're not calling cell phones. And when you have an older population or someone who can afford a cell phone and a landline, you're looking at people who might actually support Walker. So it wasn't a fully without flawed survey. You didn't have someone online looking at it. You didn't have someone standing out in the supermarket doing it. And you didn't have the phone call. So you had just that.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are trying to pick apart the methodology of the polls. Charles Marquette, though, and Charles Franklin, you know, they're pretty middle of the road people. I believe the poll. I believe the poll is an accurate snapshot, and I think it's a mistake just to say, oh, this is a lousy poll, so let's forget about it. It's not real. And let's go back to thinking it's going to be easy, because. I've always thought, you know, with Russ Feingold taking his name out there, that it was probably less than a 50-50 chance that we're going to win here. I do believe with the million signatures, that was the one moment I thought, well, maybe my skepticism and partly cloudy attitude was wrong, and I should have a sunnier disposition about it. But I am very worried.
You're not the only one that's worried. I was talking to one of the senators who was also very worried about that same thing, that they were going to lose. And it is. And when you raise $12 million and you're not using any of it to the recall and looking at the signatures, you're kind of scamming that off on the Wisconsin taxpayer, that just goes to throwing your money into radio advertising, television advertising, spam mailers, which, by the way, they put a law through sometime last year about spam mailers and for some sort of a break on that, so they help themselves by getting a break on that. So when you can do that kind of thing, and there's no one stepping up yet because of the way that, you know, we haven't even officially had a recall election yet, so no one's going to step up until that point. He has a long time to be able to spew his message, and no one's calling him on it.
Yeah, and it's just gonna be wall to wall Walker ads. I mean, he may have between $70 million and $100 million between his own fundraising and Super PAC fundraising to throw at this, and that just suggests that the Democrats need to have the absolute strongest candidate possible and a real grassroots campaign to combat all that money. So I'm wondering, you know, what's going on with those million signatures? Are they in some database of the Democratic Party or United Wisconsin? And are they able to contact those people? Do they have emails and phone numbers for those folks? And they're able to make sure all those people get to the polls? And those if each of those people brings one person to the polls, there's no way Walker's going to win. It's a question of just how well the grassroots organizing is, and also who the candidate is, though, because you can't beat Walker with no one.
That's true. You really need to have a strong candidate come out and do it. You can't just throw anyone up. It's not going to be one of those races where you get a monkey in there and they're going to win. You really have to be pushing it because he's got control of the media, basically, and can do it. Now, the John Doe investigation, we just had two arrests with that, two of his personal staffers from when he was at Milwaukee County. Where do you see that going with him, and how is that? Do you think that will actually affect his polling? Do you think that the mainstream media is really going to get out there? Really, no one's talking about but the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and it's only one guy, Mr. Bice, I believe.
Well, there was a big story in the Wisconsin State Journal today by Mary Spicuzza, Clay Barber, and Dee Hall, and Dee Hall's a prize-winning reporter who broke the first scandal here with the caucuses. So I was pleased to see this big front-page story in the State Journal today, and it's getting closer and closer to Walker. I mean, they've got some of Walker's chief aides here now under indictment, and chief fundraisers also, And there's a quote from Walker himself in one of these complaints, I guess, where he was telling his staffer that we just can't have another incident like this of people being caught working on political campaigns on public time, and he says, you know, we can't afford another story like this one. And he was just cautioning people that this is really dangerous. So maybe the people who are being arrested here, some of them may be giving immunity or partial immunity for testimony that may be against him ultimately. And then how ironic it would be if Scott Walker were to lose the recall election, not because of his hideous assault on working people and collective bargaining rights and the environment and the schools and in tribal lands up north, but because of these corruption scandals, now because of this campaign finance problem. So it's getting quite interesting, I got to say.
It is. They do. They keep circling closer and closer to Walker. And I know there was one of the people arrested, the one gentleman that was associated with Davis, I believe. He actually is looking for immunity and going to do a plea bargain. They said that. So that should be interesting to see what he comes with. The other fun thing I thought was interesting, I'm not sure how this is going to work with Rebecca Clayfish, is that it came out that Walker wanted Davis as lieutenant governor, not Clayfish.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a not so well-kept secret that Clayfish wasn't his first choice for lieutenant governor, and that is just confirmed by these new complaints that came out.
What do you think about what happened in the gallery last night with the complete shutting down of the gallery during the assembly? Someone brought up an interesting point that by shutting down the gallery while the assembly is in session, it technically is called a closed session at that point, and that by state law you cannot have closed sessions of the assembly.
Yeah, I think it's just outrageous. I wasn't there. I wish I was there last night. I wasn't there. But it is unbelievable that they are doing the people's business after kicking the people out from being any citizens from being able to watch what was going on. And this is just another instance of how repressive the Walker administration is getting, how suppressive it's getting when it comes to free speech rights. And I wouldn't be surprised at some point soon if they did actually start to try to enforce the law, not the law, but the edict that they issued about not having more than three people in there unless you get a permit 72 hours beforehand. So that worries me. It worries me also from the accounts that I was reading about what happened last night, that there was selective eviction of people from the galleries. And that is that the pro-Walker people were allowed to make noise and the anti-Walker people weren't. And so I think that's a real problem. When were you there last night?
I was there for State of the State Wednesday, and I was there all last night. I was there when they shut down the gallery. And so I was there even before that, around, I don't even know the time, 5:30 or so. What they ended up doing was they started, as the Republicans were talking about the mining bill, a couple of people started coughing and saying bull crap. I can't use the word they were saying as they were coughing. And at some point, the Republicans, I think it was Kramer, the pro tem speaker, said, "We're closing the entire gallery." Mark Pocan stood up and said, "No." And they argued it for 4 minutes on the floor. And Kramer finally said, "You know what? The offender apparently left because one guy had left and was yelling some swears that he walked out." And he said, "Apparently we got the offender." He said, "I'm going to keep the gallery open, but it will not bother me one bit to close it down."
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, they unfurled a banner from the gallery that hung down and said, "Bury the bill." And at that point, I was not in the assembly at the time, but I heard, I was in the Capitol, and they went over the speaker, when you can hear it in the rooms, basically said the assembly's going to stand informal while we clear the gallery. And then everyone poured out, and they stood right by the assembly doors and started yelling, and they were doing mic checks, and everyone just kind of stood there.
How many people were there?
You know, I'm not really good with estimations in the crowd, but I'd say at least 50.
Mm-hmm.
At least 50.
And these were representatives of some of the tribes and also activists who've been doing protests for months and months?
Most of the tribe members had left by then. There might have been some smattering of them in there, but most of them had to leave by 6. It's a long drive home. But it was the protesters, and some of them weren't even protesters. Some of them I had never seen before. They were just people there watching the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a smattering of people of all types that were sitting and watching the gallery, and they were quiet after they got reprimanded the first time. Everyone was really quiet. You didn't hear much from them after that. So they apparently the banner was too much for them, and they just closed the gallery. And then after they closed the gallery, apparently some of the representatives came out and said, "We're trying to get you back in. It would do you some good to be quiet so we could do that," because apparently they passed the mining bill, and then once they passed the mining bill, they actually had to be on the floor and argue to reopen the gallery so people could come in and watch the rest of the bill.
Hmm. Wow, it just sounds crazy. And this is just, to me, there's occasion to protest loudly, understanding that you're going to get kicked out, kicking people out for holding a banner or a sign or taking out cell phones and things like that, that's ludicrous. And also it's anti-democratic to not allow anyone into the gallery and watching their elected officials do their job, or the job that we put them there to do anyway. So I wish I'd been there last night. It sounds exciting.
It was. And actually, at the first 4 minutes of the argument, you had Mark Pocan stood up, and I'm actually going to play what he said a little bit later in the show, but he actually says, he turns to Republicans and say, you're all good with the Second Amendment. How about looking at the First Amendment now? And then after he talks about it, Jeff Fitzgerald stands up and says, we need to close the gallery. We don't have to have swears at us. We shouldn't have to have this. The whole gallery has to be closed. I mean, he was rude. And then when the guy was yelling the profanity as he was walking out, Jeff was responding to him. And I call him Fitz Walker because I can't, Jeff and Scott, the three of them, they're all kind of the same person, so I just call him Jeff Fitz Walker. Mm-hmm. And so Jeff responded to him going, oh, yeah, that's classy. Oh, yeah, that's really classy. It was just awful. And that's when Kramer spoke up and said, apparently the offender's gone. We'll keep people in, but, I'll close at any moment. And then Barker stood up and said, we do have to keep decorum, but let's throw out the people who are causing the problems and not the whole gallery. And at the same time, they're saying all this stuff they are people that are using profanity, but you have 10 cops up there. I mean, you can't tell me that they can't pick out one or two people and remove them if they have to, which is a whole nother situation, really.
Right.
But you have 10 cops up there. What are they going to do? It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, when I was up there and got arrested on November 1st, I mean, we knew what we were doing. We knew that we were risking arrest. We were willing to do that. But not everyone up there was doing it. There were people there who wanted to watch the proceedings or give support to those of us who were getting out the cell phones or holding signs and things. So to throw everybody out just seems to be excessive, to say the least.
And that was the argument. That was really the argument that the Dems were doing. And the Dems were saying, we should get along. This is excessive. We're overreacting. And the Republicans are like, we don't care.
But, and to me what it suggests is the whole attitude of Scott Walker, the Fitzgeralds, and the far-right Republican Party that's come to dominate our state over the last year, they consider the people just a nuisance. The people are like mosquitoes to them, and they want to fumigate and just do their business, and their business is helping corporations in Wisconsin or out-of-state corporations come to Wisconsin. They don't care about the people. They don't care about the people's environment. They don't care about anything public, any sense of a public good, and the public just gets in their way. And so clearing the gallery is symbolic of what they want to do to the entire state.
Exactly. And they would prefer it that way. If they could just have the lobbyists come in and talk to them and their donors come in and talk to them, that seems to be where they like to be.
Yeah, and I think if Walker were to win this recall election, I think the edict about, no more than three people in the Capitol at once, I think then it would be, if he hadn't enforced it yet, he'd enforce it then and just throw out the solidarity sing-along and anybody else who wanted to go in there. So I think that's the future that we're looking at if he were to win re-election.
Well, I had a story of a gentleman from the Red Cliff Reservation, and he basically said he came down to play his drum, and playing the drum for the Native people is a very spiritual thing, and he was doing it in honor of the ancestors, and they gave him a citation for it and said he needed a permit to do it. He didn't have a permit, and so he gave him a citation of $260, I believe, $240, something in that range.
And he was just drumming in the rotunda?
He was drumming in the rotunda. He was actually drumming to call the ancestors in. It was a spiritual thing that they do, and he was drumming.
And why would they arrest him and not the sing-alongs?
I don't know. They gave him a citation. I believe he said he was arrested and cited and left, and they said that he needed a permit for it, and that's what he had said. And he's like, I don't even fully understand what they wanted.
I mean, it is pretty brazen, the total disregard for Native rights that the Republicans have demonstrated over the last week. I know one Republican legislator said, you know, I wasn't elected to give the tribes a seat at the table. I mean, this person has no understanding of tribal rights here in Wisconsin or in the United States for that matter. And just to stomp all over Native rights, both as far as listening to them and hearing their testimony and also just letting them drum in the rotunda, it's just appalling.
Yep. No, that's the people we're dealing with. Matt, I have to get going, and I know you do too. Thank you so much for being on the show today. It's always a blast when you're on, and I look forward to you coming on again.
Sarah, I can't wait to do it. Have a nice day. Have a nice weekend.
Yep, you too. I'll talk to you later. That was Matt Rothschild with the Progressive Magazine, and you could go to his website at www.progressive.org. Now we're going to go straight to Lori Campus, who is on. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I know you don't have a lot of time, so we're going to get right to it. Lori Campus was the amazing person who set up the Fitzgerald recall, the Scott Fitzgerald recall, and actually did it. So can you explain real fast how that got started again?
Sure. Well, first of all, my name is Lori Campus, with C-O-M-P-A-S, and I started the recall on my own, right before the deadline for Walker's recall. I realized that no one seemed to be filing for him. And I was starting to hear things about the other Senate recalls and just kind of wondering why no one was filing for Scott Fitzgerald. So I called the Government Accountability Board and learned how to create a petition and how to file and everything. And I just did it.
And how did you keep it going? I mean, once you started working it and realizing that there was a lot of work involved with this, how did you keep things going?
Well, I started a website and a Facebook page and a Twitter account, and all those things kind of worked together to kind of get the word out. But the really difficult work was, you know, conducted by the volunteers on the ground. So I printed up the petitions, delivered them to various offices around the district, and volunteers, when they came in to get the Walker petitions, were given the option of taking a Fitzgerald petition as well. And obviously a lot of them took us up on that offer and carried our petitions, and we had hundreds of circulators out there getting signatures for us.
Now, you ran it out of your kitchen on almost no money. It was just amazing what you could do just by basically sure will and want to get this guy out. What was the one thing that he did or a couple of things that he did that you just said, you know what, he's got to go. I can't handle this anymore.
It was definitely for me, it was the evening of March 9th, 2011. I was on my way to a rally that we were having in our town in Fort Atkinson. The Rock River runs through town, and the Main Street Bridge crosses over the river, and we were going to have a rally to support education and, you know, all the things that were coming under attack in this administration. And I was on my way there, and I was checking my phone, checking Twitter on my phone, and all of a sudden, I just remember Twitter just seemed to explode with, they're having a meeting in the Capitol, and they didn't announce it properly. And sure enough, Scott Fitzgerald was convening a meeting that he had not noticed properly. It was in violation of the open meetings law. And I just remember watching it on the news that night and thinking, this guy's got to go. And, you know, I thought I would just carry a clipboard. And it's really weird to find myself in this position where, you know, no one else was going to do this, and I did. So, that's what sparked it for me. And I think that's what really makes a lot of people's stomach churn is just that night, seeing that meeting. And you can see it on YouTube. Peter Barkas standing up, yelling, saying, this is a violation of the law, you know. It just, no matter what you think about the policies that these guys have pushed through, I don't think anyone can argue that the procedure has just been really backdoor, underhanded stuff.
Oh, definitely. I remember watching it on the news, too, and I was in a place I couldn't get down there. But my first instinct was, I got to get to the Capitol because this is awful. So luckily, unluckily, none of my senators or representatives were involved with that, so I couldn't do anything about it. But I'm glad that you did. Now that the Fitz recall is all over, have you encountered any backlash from the Fitz supporters?
No, not that I've seen. I have heard one of our volunteers, the petitions have been scanned and placed online, and one of our best volunteers did report that she got a harassing phone call, but I think she went ahead and reported that to the police. We just want to nip that kind of thing in the bud. But no, I think everybody realizes this is our constitutional right to do this. They might not agree with it, but, you've got to respect the rule of law.
Now, how has your life changed since the after being involved in the Fitzgerald or Fitzwalker recall?
I really haven't slept very much. I'm busy all the time. I thought that I would hand in the petitions on the 17th and be done with this and get back to my normal life. And I actually did schedule. I'm a freelance writer and photographer, so I scheduled a lot of work starting on the 18th of January so I could kind of, catch up on the backlog of everything that had gotten pushed aside over the prior 2 months. And so, yeah, it's just, I've got all my normal responsibilities. I'm the coordinator of the ski club at our kids' school and the garden club and, all these things that I just kind of did as a normal person. But I'm realizing now that the recall effort was not over the day we handed in the petitions. It's an ongoing process, and we're going to have to defend some of our signatures. And, it's just a really busy time.
Well, what's next for Recall Fitz? What's the next step for you guys?
Well, we are talking about who is going to challenge Fitzgerald in the election and how to best challenge him. I mean, I would like to see the candidate go head-to-head with Fitzgerald, but I'm afraid that he's going to run fake Democrats. And, so we're just talking about all different possibilities and kind of gaming it out different ways and thinking about how it could play out.
So basically you're going to take the Recall Fitz group and kind of help the candidate who's going to come after Fitzwalker and kind of help them get elected.
Right. So we are working on voter registration and photo ID right now. One of our amazing volunteers has organized a group of people to do data entry. So we now have all the people who circulated our petitions entered into a database, and we're going to be contacting them, hoping that they will help us out with the election. And really right now, since we're just kind of in this weird limbo, we're waiting for the review period to be over, I'm really urging people to get deputized. That means go to your municipality and just get a little form filled out that says that you can register people to vote. Part of the photo ID law that passed is this new rule that no longer can you go to one municipality, get deputized there, and then be deputized across the entire state. You have to go to each municipality where you want to register voters and get deputized in that municipality. And in a big district like ours, there's a lot of municipalities. So that's what we're working on right now is getting volunteers deputized and getting them out there registering people to vote. Because I think, frankly, the more people who vote, the better our chances of winning.
Well, and obviously the people in his district are not happy with Fitzwalker. And if they were, you wouldn't be getting the signatures you got. And I bet you could have gotten a heck of a lot more.
Oh, yeah. If we'd had more time, we could have gotten more, of course.
So it's not like you were barely getting the mark you got. You probably could have doubled that easily if you had a little more time to do that. Now, what was the overall feeling in his district as you were doing it?
Well, it varied a lot. I mean, there were some people who said they supported Walker and wouldn't sign any recall petitions. There were some people who would not sign Walker's petition but were happy to sign Scott Fitzgerald's. And then, of course, there were obviously a lot of people who signed all three.
So there was a lot of support in the area then for you.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, some people were so eager to sign Fitzgerald's petition. You know, they would just say, where's the Fitz one? I want to sign that one first. So I think people really feel like he changed over the past year. He seemed to get this agenda from somewhere, and there's a lot of speculation as to where it came from. But we know it didn't come from us. And it's interesting, you know, talking to community leaders and stuff and just seeing how badly these policies have hurt our communities.
And what are they saying? How bad have they hurt?
Well, you know, it varies from community to community, and it varies from, you know, the schools to infrastructure projects. It's kind of all over the map, and I'm just starting to form a really good picture of what people need in these various small towns. And, I mean, to a person, what I'm hearing is that he just doesn't listen. And he is so focused on stuff going on outside the district. I mean, if you look at his fundraising, he's raising money from people in New York and Florida and, you know, everywhere but here. So people are just frustrated that he's not listening to us.
Well, he's just probably going out with Scott Walker, and they're probably just fundraising together. So they do everything else together. Lori, I know you have to get going. Thank you so much for being on with us. Good luck in getting everyone registered and getting them out to vote and whatever you decide to do after that.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm sure we'll have you on again talking about getting people out there and campaigning against him. So you just keep up the good fight and the good work, Lori, and we're all behind you.
Thanks, and good luck to you.
Oh, well, thank you. I'll talk to you later then.
Bye.
Bye. We are coming on a break, and after this break, you will hopefully we'll have some callers. I was hoping Jason would call in to talk about what happened in the gallery last night. And if he doesn't call, though, I have some other things, some other recordings I haven't played yet from yesterday you can hear. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Hi, this is Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse. You can find us on iTunes. President Barack Obama gave his third State of the Union address earlier this week, where he laid out the plans for his final year in office and hopefully his second term. He started off by talking about the end of the Iraq War, as well as the fact that Osama bin Laden is no longer a threat to the United States for the first time in two decades, and Al-Qaeda has been defeated. He compared soldiers to Congress and spoke of how soldiers work together to get the job done regardless of their differences. He suggested that Congress should follow their example. He then went on to lay out several plans and explain to the American people in a very subtle way that he needs Congress to act for him to make a difference. He stated that he would continue to fight for this economy with or without Congress and be happy to work with anybody who was willing to work with him, but he will fight obstructionism at all costs. People are understanding that the President of the United States has limited powers, as this is a democracy, not a monarchy. The people are now noticing that Congress is very often to blame more so than the President. Congress's approval rating is down into the single digits, and more people are suggesting that the Democrats will take back the House, possibly hold the Senate, and Barack Obama will be reelected due to record filibusters and nothing getting through the House of Representatives, showing that the Republicans' plan to tank the economy and blame it on the President is backfiring. I'm Eric Brandt, and that's just something to think about.
You know, again, we're overreacting. You know, we are. You know, I don't know what it is. Y'all love the Second Amendment, but try the First, okay? Now, a few people, we would prefer, if you want to stay in your seats, they're going to throw you out if you say something, all right? And if you cough and say something, you're going to get thrown out. If you want to get thrown out, do it all at once and get out of here, all right? Because otherwise, they're going to clear the entire gallery, and that's not going to be helpful. But to throw the whole gallery out, Mr. Speaker, is wrong. You're overreacting.
Okay.
So, well, I'll talk for a while. I've got a long-ass point of order then, Mr. Speaker, all right? We have to start behaving a little differently here. Now, a few people made a comment or made a cough. Now, we can try to get that under control, but to clear the entire gallery for that reason, Mr. Speaker, is unnecessary and unwarranted, and I think after last year, it's time we start learning how to behave like a body that can work together.
That was Mark Pocan speaking out against the first attempt to clear the gallery. Now, what you didn't hear was the response from Jeff Fitzgerald, and then, of course, that was Bill Cramer, which you kind of heard the okay in the background. He's the Speaker pro tem because Jeff Fitzwalker doesn't do that for some reason. He kind of sits and watches, but he doesn't actually do the speaker very much. And then you had Peter Barca, who responded at the end. And I'm going to have that podcasted so you guys can hear it. I'll send it out and you guys can listen to that. I don't have the whole thing up. But it was really interesting, the responses. Now, the screaming, as Mark Pocan was trying to talk, that it was just some coughing. The noise you heard, those are the Republicans on the floor with him. And then when he said, let's try the first, that was the gallery. And you heard them be really quiet once he said, you guys got to be quiet. And that's what Barca also said. Representative Barca said, got to be quiet. We have to respect the policies. You know, at those who don't respect it will have to leave, but the rest of you should stay. And I wasn't on the floor when they actually called the gallery to be cleared, but I didn't hear any noises in the background either. Like, you could hear the noises before, and I didn't hear any noise until after they cleared the gallery, and then it got really loud. And it was just not good. It was not good. I downloaded a couple of the videos that I took. I got some mic checks that went on in there. At one point, they mic checked to write a message to the legislature asking them when it's going to be about the people and not about the legislatures. So it was a very interesting evening. There was a lot of yelling of shame once they closed the gallery. And it really is a sad fact, very sad fact, that the assembly members had to argue to open up the assembly gallery so people can actually watch their state assembly work. We pay these people with our tax money. They work for us. We don't work for them. They don't work for the lobbyists don't work for them unless they're taxpayers. But, you know, the lobbyists and the donors are not the only people they should be listening to. They really should be listening to us, and apparently they don't. And it's just a sad comment on where we're at right now as a state due to our leadership, which would be Scott Walker, Scott Fitzwalker, or Fitzgerald, and Jeff Fitzgerald. So what I want to play, though, I want to play the, if I can find it here, there is, I want to play the interview I did with the gentleman who was arrested for playing his drum, and I'll let him actually explain to you how important the drum is and what occurred. I am speaking here today with
Bajik Migasiyanini, Indigenous Cause. From Musquabi Kong, Red Cliff. My English name is Sam Morris.
And he was arrested today and cited for playing a drum in the rotunda. Now, can you explain a little bit about the native drumming and how sacred and important that is to the culture?
Yes, we do it to communicate with the other side, with the spirit world, talk to through the songs, like sing to the spirits, to bring happiness and, you know, good feelings around. So it ain't like we're trying to do anything bad. We're trying to keep it all positive.
So it's basically your way of letting the ancestors know, we're here, we would like you to come and join us as we are speaking out against the mine.
Yeah.
And what happened at that point then as you were drumming?
The officers come up and they said that I can't be drumming because something about some rule that they have here. I quite didn't understand it.
So basically they had very little respect for the culture that you're from and why you were drumming, and just said you just couldn't do it.
Right. They gave me a disorderly conduct. They said you can't be drumming because you got to have a permit to do it here.
And didn't take anything else into account. Did you explain to them what you were doing?
Yeah, I did. I went down in the room and I explained it to them, you know. I was nice to them and everything. They are cops.
And they still gave you the citation then?
Yes. They still gave me the citation.
And how much was the citation for?
$263. I don't need for the money. It's more for my culture and for my belief and for my people in all nations.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I'm very sorry that it happened, and I'm very sorry that it happened here. It's the people's house, and if you're going to drum to the ancestors, you really should be able to drum to the ancestors.
Yep, Miigwech.
Miigwech. Now, Miigwech actually is like a farewell, because the natives never say bye. It's just their way of saying farewell. So, but it tells you how uninformed this administration is on some of the people that they're actually serving in the state of Wisconsin. As it was said on the floor, said they are a sovereign nation, but they're also members of Wisconsin. And yet their needs, the understanding of their culture, the mining debacle that's going on would affect so much of that. And we have a governor and two people that are running, well, actually we have three people basically running the state, Governor Walker and then Scott and Jeff, because they're able to pull up the bills that they want and none of the bills that they don't want. And none of them seem to really get the Native community. They don't seem to understand the cultural differences. They don't seem to even respect the fact that there is someone different in this state. And it's not just the Native community that's different. We have Hmong. We have other people of color that bring in their traditions and their culture in here. And it seems that none of that is being respected right now. What we have is an administration that only respects lobbyists and people that donate to them. If you can't afford to donate to them, like I tell people, I can't afford to have my own legislature. I can't afford to have one. If you can't do that, then your voice doesn't get heard. You're not a lobbyist, your voice doesn't get heard. When he rewrote the law, because at some point after he said three or more people, they came out with a little amendment to that, and they basically said, well, if you have a family of three more, it's okay. Or if you're in a lobbying group of three or more, it's okay. But everyone else needs a permit. They specifically had to put lobbyists in there. Is that really necessary? Unfortunately, those are the people that are being listened to. Those are the people that are really pushing these agendas, and that's why we have what we have right now. We have a leader who just doesn't even care about the people in Wisconsin, doesn't even try to learn about the different cultures here, doesn't care about it as long as he gets what he wants out of it. If you guys haven't seen the Wisconsin State Journal's photo of him, that photo was taken just as he walked up to the podium right before he said his State of the State. He looks like the smuggest person on the face of the earth. He's like the cat that just grabbed the canary. He was in his glory. It's all about Walker. That's our problem. We don't have a leader who's doing anything for the betterment of the state. We have a leader who's doing something for the betterment of himself. And it'd be really nice to get the state moving forward and get a leader who's actually going to think about the state and think less about his own or her own aspirations. So on that, I'd like to thank you all for listening today. I'd like to thank Bill for all his hard work on the show, my producer. You can download the show from iTunes, or you can listen to the archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. You can also listen to the Sarah Schultz Show off the Sarah Schultz Show app for Android phones and iPhones. You turn in Saturday, or tune in Saturday. You know, I can talk, really. It just isn't happening today, apparently. You can tune in Saturday at 6 p.m. to WIDE 99.1 FM in Madison. And on Tuesday at 1 p.m. on WHYS 96.3 FM in Eau Claire. Remember, Wisconsin forward, together forward. Have a great week, everyone. I'll catch you next week.